homeland in hip-hop. To think about the origins of hip-hop in this culture, and also about homeland security, is to see that there are, at the very least, two worlds in America. One of the well-to-do, and another of the struggling.
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and you're listening to The Mark Steiner Show right here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. That's Homeland and Hip-Hop by Immortal Technique, featuring Mumia Abu-Jamal. Mumia was born on this day in 1954. In this hour, we're listening to the latest installment of our World in the Play series, where we look at the latest production at Everyman Theater and wrestle with some of the deep issues within those plays. The production we discussed this time was Ghosts, by Henrik Ibsen, which deals with women's power in 19th century Europe, secrets families kept, and the ways in which our puritanical societies make us keep secrets about the most important things in our lives. Enjoy. And so this particular discussion today, Ghosts, the cost of keeping a secret, and coming out of this, obviously, out of play, Ghosts, that most of you have seen, and Donald Hicken is with us at the very end there. Donald Hicken, who directed this play, he's been a director for 30 years, a long time, Donald. and of course, is the head of the theater department at Baltimore School for the Arts, and knows a great deal about Ibsen, this period, and I'm really happy he agreed to be part of this panel today, and he's an old friend, good to have you here. And next to him is Samara Stone, who is a licensed certified social worker, clinical social worker, and she knows a great deal about what motivates us as human beings, individuals, and works with people as clients and in groups. And we're happy to have her here to kind of flesh this part of Ibsen, not Ibsen, but what this play says to us out that way. And sitting next to me is Dr. Jean Fernandez, who is Associate Professor of English at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. And her book fits perfectly, Victorian Servants, Class, and Politics, of Literacy. So we have a lot to talk about here, and good to have all of us here. So, and all of you, and we'll get to the audience and your thoughts and questions, too, to be part of this discussion. So let's begin. Secrets, in a very general sense. The idea of secrets, every family has their secrets. We all keep them in. So, you know, and we think these secrets are kind of bad, and that the secrets are things that can hurt us in the end because they're kept away from the rest. So what about secrets? I mean, are secrets a negative thing in families? Do I bet you there's not a family we know that doesn't have secrets.
Absolutely. I'll take that when we're talking about families. I mean, I believe that secrets have a self-protective function for families, especially when certain human dynamics are occurring and they're exposed to the light of day, then they have to manage a lot of the shame and judgment that other people carry around the situations that are happening. But there's this tipping point when secrets can become unhealthy. And we certainly saw that in the play. I mean, we'd reached maybe secret critical mass where the secret had become so weighty and so heavy that it infected the entire family system and even the community to a large degree.
Donald.
I think that Ibsen dealt with this from an early age because, you know, his family, his father was shamed. You know, his father had gotten into some bad business deals and had probably defrauded or created a kind of a fraudulent situation, and the family was ruined. And so Ibsen lived with this, I don't know that it was a secret, but he lived with this shame. And I think it led him to view the world through the lens of a person who had, at an early age, had to protect and had to tell lies and had to avoid the truth. There's a lot in the play about, you know, truth versus ideals. And, you know, Manders talks about the importance of ideals as a way of keeping society stable. But here you have these truths that Mrs. Alving wants to reveal in order to feel free. I think she feels captive to these lies and these old stories that that everyone has been protecting all these years. And so I think that that, for me, was the real central organizing tension in the piece, is this notion of truth versus ideals. Do we tell lies and keep secrets in order to preserve a construct, or are we liberated by personal truths and stuff? And so that's kind of where we, how we approached it kind of from the beginning. I mean, my favorite scene, we were talking about this earlier, my favorite scene is this moment when Manders is really confronted with his actual feelings for Mrs. Alving. And she's really calling him out. And he's standing on his doctrine. He's standing on his position. He's being the minister. And you can see the chinks in the armor. And I think it's that, to me, is the really the essential moment in the play in terms of the idea that Ibsen was wrestling with. This. And I think also, you know, he was trying to examine what, you know, what was happening to women and in under these constructs. He really wanted to see. He wrote this play because he wanted to see what would happen to Honora from Doll's House. He wanted to see what how she might grow over time and circumstance. And he felt compelled to give her a voice because women at the time had no voice. They were, you know, basically sitting in the corner with their mouths shut. You know, they weren't expected to say anything, let alone the truth.
So, I mean, so in many ways, you know, this we're looking at this play here, and I think this. Let me take this vantage point for a moment and bring us to the present, but start back then. That the idea of secrets and how they may have developed in this period that we call the Victorian period, right? When the nuclear family became, started really becoming the centerpiece, and people shutting their blinds, and especially the middle class and bourgeoisie going inside their homes, and a different world was being created. So secrets meant something different. We began to, and women had this kind of very subservient role, right?
Yes.
So this, and that's a piece of this secret keeping.
Yes, you're right. That this is the era when the bourgeois family and bourgeois values are emerging. And I think it was Freud who said, well, the word Heimlich means both homely and hidden. And there's this saying someone once made, every family has a secret, and its secret is that it's not like any other family. So secrets here are a matter of both, it's a burden and a power, it's about burden, a burden as well as a kind of power, the power dynamics that emerge when you have secrecy. And what struck me in the play was the way there is this culture of silence. It's really hard to come to voice because the sheer force of official rhetoric is so powerful in you know, the voice of Manders. And it's interesting that Mrs. Alving is struggling for voice. You know, there are some words never mentioned in this play, like syphilis, never mentioned. There are all these words that simply never get uttered in the course of the play, so that it's not just a question of being cathartic and, you know, opening up, but it's also struggling against all the repression that is being culturally imposed, you know, upon people at this time. And, of course, as women were custodians of family reputation, but women were also compelled to live according to some very powerful stereotypes. The angel in the house who was pious and devoted and the keeper of sweet order, versus the fallen woman. And it's really interesting how in the process of, you know, what happens in the play, Mrs. Alving begins to recognize that these stereotypes don't hold water. She's married for money. She's prostituted herself in a way. So it's not just secrets about the husband, the erring husband, but it's also secrets that compel people to face who they are internally, which I think becomes quite a crisis in Victorian culture, though I think it's still a crisis even today.
Well, that's what I was thinking, which you just said, and Samara, I was thinking about how the thing that this play puts out to us about secrets in life and women and is something, it's the legacy they've given us now. You know, it permeates where we are now in terms of how we deal in our families, our society.
Absolutely. One of the things I was most intrigued by is watching the woman go through her own process of coming to terms with the impact of her secrets. In the beginning, you know, she really kind of demonized the husband and had this very ogre-like appearance of the way that he behaved, but by the end, she'd very much softened and started to see him as really pushing against, you know, his joy for life, pressing against this repressive society that they were living in. And I think that awareness, that compassion, it was fruit of her coming to terms with her own choices that she'd made around how she managed her child. And really owning that, I think, helped her to see him in a different type of light. So when I think about the way that we function in society today, the more that we are able to lead with compassion for the choices that people make, you know, it helps us to come to terms with those choices that we're making ourselves that are less than perfect, right?
So are secrets are secrets a bad thing? Are secrets something that should be kept? You know, we always is it a negative force in us and our families?
I think that there's a sense of the motivation behind the secret and the level of shame and the repression that's being used to maintain it. Sometimes if people are just private, they're not maybe willing to share the details of their own personal lives. That's a totally natural and normal way to approach interacting in a society. Those boundaries are important and appropriate. But when we are ashamed of the content of the story, not that we just, you know, don't share the details, but if we're ashamed, then that shame is what starts to burn at the soul. And that is the problem of the secret. So the secret is in and of itself not the issue. It's the force with which you have to hold it that creates the problem.
And even the secrets we keep, I think, sometimes seep into us, mm-hmm. even if we don't know what the secret is.
You know, I think it's really interesting, you know, looking at the set design of this play. You know, the earlier play, A Doll's House, has a purely social setting, and Nora is able to leave. She walks out, she slams the door, and she's gone, having performed this duty to herself. But the action in this play takes place somewhere on the borders between the social and the natural. You know, you've got this garden house, and you have this gloomy natural background with the rain coming down, almost pressing into the social world. And here is Mrs. Alving trying to find social solutions for her secret, trying to raise memorials, trying to perhaps commemorate, you know, the name of her husband, trying to perhaps dispatch her son to a safer environment. But it's as if there is some kind of natural force operating that will somehow propel what has been hidden into the open. And so secrets and the life of secrets seem to possess a power all their own. No matter how much we struggle against, you know, managing secrets, that's what the play seems to suggest. But somehow there's this natural world where, this natural law where perhaps, you know, everything that's been buried comes back to haunt you in the way in which the sun comes back now, you know, afflicted with syphilis.
I love the young woman's response to the secret. As soon as she learned the truth of her parentage, you watched her become empowered and develop a strategic approach to how she was going to manage that. Mm-hmm. It didn't feel to me that she felt burdened by that, but emboldened.
That's so true.
And so I think generationally how we view secrets changes as we continue to evolve too. I mean, she felt to me not to be someone that was going to stuff that, but she used it as fodder to build this new life.
Donald?
Well, it's fascinating to hear your perceptions of the, you know, the setting and everything, because we talked about that, you know, Daniel Attinger, who's a set designer, we talked about this from the beginning. I said it can't feel like a home. It can't feel like a comfortable place. It has to be a kind of a cold, weird sort of transitional place. And we imagined it to be Alving's meeting room, you know, where he would have his official gatherings, that it was not I didn't want it to feel like a living room. And the fact that the first act on stage is Regina bringing in a bouquet of flowers was intended to kind of suggest that here's a chance, we're all trying to make this feel a little bit better because, you know, Oswald is here, and so we're trying to make something for Oswald. Although the bouquet of flowers became a constant hazard for us. I couldn't get people out from behind the flowers. They were always in. But I it's fascinating to me that, you know, what you said about Regina and how she adjusted to her circumstance. And, you know, we approached it to a great extent as if it were a love story. Because I think in some ways it is a love story. And I think in an important way, we talk about secrets and lies. I think that the protecting was an act of love. But I also feel that, you know, what Ibsen was looking for ultimately was forgiveness. And the final act in the play is an act of forgiveness. You know, she's going to help him die, and that is an act of love, and it's an act of forgiveness. And I think that that's maybe what he was talking about. That maybe the antidote to all of this secrecy and all of these lies is forgiveness. That we understand that this is human behavior. You know, in my own life, I know my mother kept the secret of my parentage until I didn't find out until after she had died. She carried it with her all her life. And my brother finally, you know, told me that he and I had been parented by a man who was not the person we assumed was our father all of our lives. And so learning that at age 21 was a pretty remarkable experience for me. But At first, I didn't know what to do with it, you know. I was in college, and I was, you know, having a life, and I was moving forward. But it explained a lot to me, you know. I understood my mother in a way that I never understood her before. She was always a bit of an enigma in my life. Pious and judgmental and, you know, very restricted and... But when I learned what she had been battling with, you know, a life of sin, which is how she defined it, then I was able to be compassionate in a new way toward her. I was able to forgive her in a way that I never could have before. So I think that maybe the antidote to this is, you know, truth is, my brother said we have to go, and because we had all these other relatives, my brother said we have to go and meet them. I said, let's not go meet them. Let's leave them alone, you know. They don't need to know that they have these, you know. Well, a long story short, turns out they did know, and they'd all been hiding it. In fact, my half-sister was writing a fictional biography of my real father. Wow. So, you know, we shook them down. I mean, we told them the truth. And I don't know that they were better for it. But I think everybody came away from that whole experience a little more mindful, a little more enlightened, mm-hmm. and perhaps more forgiving as a result of it. So even though I said first, let's not do it, I'm glad we did.
Absolutely.
I'm not sure they are glad we did, but I'm glad we did.
You know, we never regret sharing something that strengthens human bonds, right? When you talked about this being the human experience, those vulnerabilities, the times when we're able to talk about what people actually do and not just what people are supposed to do, yeah. It inspires a connection, a human connection with folks. And that's where the compassion and the understanding for what people are dealing with really comes from. And I think I saw that in the play with, again, her shifting in her perspective of who the husband was, and then watching her son kind of battle his own demons. I mean, towards the end, she was almost kind of facilitating him drinking and enjoying life and kind of having this mm-hmm. very different idea about what he was doing, because she was seeing it through the eyes of love and not judgment.
Yeah. So if secrets...
You know, I don't know if I really want to take as optimistic a view of the play as, you know, both of you have. Regina, you know, she's this very tough, cynical woman, I think, by the end. And, you know, the whole question of class relations as well as gender relations came through for me in the play. It was interesting to me because, you know, from the 19th century standpoint, there was this hysteria over venereal disease, and it became quite a discourse of class where the source of infection was located in the prostitute, the lower class woman, who was then supposed to infect the upper class man. And of course, because people had no real medical science behind them, this belief in hereditary syphilis meant that the lower classes were waging a kind of war on the upper classes, who would inevitably end up, therefore, extinct due to this kind of physical corruption through immorality. It's pretty interesting to me that while the son, Oscar, is infected, the daughter, Regina, is healthy. And there are these moments where Oscar's, you know, gaze on lingers on Regina. And it seems lustful, but he's also talking of how energetic she is, what strength she seems to embody. And I think to the 19th century audience, that would have conveyed a certain kind of anxiety. You know, Regina walks out at the end. She says, look, I have youth, I have looks, that's all I've got, mm-hmm. and I've got to make the most of it. And so there's a kind of hard-bitten cynicism here as she walks out on this dying artist and intellectual, sensitive but doomed. And, you know, Mrs. Alving's final words, yes, no, yes, no. They've got to a point, to me, where words don't have meaning anymore. You know, it doesn't matter whether she does or doesn't comply with her son's desires. You know, she's doomed either way. Yeah. So Regina was an interesting, you know, I think, contrast in some ways as well. It was a little more complex to me.
Fascinating to hear you talk about that. That last bit, you know, after she leaves, mm-hmm. that last, 10 minutes, were the most challenging for us, you know, as we developed it. Because, you know, as a director, I'm listening a lot to what the actors are thinking and feeling, and you know, we're trying things. And I said, I think it's just chaos. I think it just descends into chaos at that point. You know, there's no logical form, and it's characterized in that yes, yes, no, no,
yes.
No, no, yes, yeah. It was very challenging.
And
so that. I mean, in some ways, I think that it's the chaos that secrets, no matter where they come from, create. You know, that the revealing of a secret causes chaos, whether the chaos ends up being something that you take in stride or take a positive way, the chaos of being very angry about the secrets being kept, and it could really destroy you personally because you've had these secrets and it's burning inside you, what that caused, that secret caused you. The idea of secrets here and what they do to a human being, I think is not, and it, what comes out of this play is, that's part of it, is why this conversation is around secrets, is because what they do to us when they are revealed.
You know, Mark, you use the word costs of secrets. And I was particularly struck by the nexus between silence and money in this play. People being paid off to keep silent, people being paid off to marry somebody in trouble, people being paid off in so many different ways. You know, so I was just struck by that.
I guess as you were talking about the nature of secrets, I really thought about in the therapeutic process what it's like for someone when they finally bring air to their secrets in a therapeutic setting. I mean, it's this beautiful moment where not only are they showing and exposing something that they feel has been so ugly, but to have it then enveloped in acceptance and nurturance, I mean, it is the most transformative and cathartic experience. That's why I love what therapy offers, because it's this safe place where secrets can kind of linger in the room and they don't have the social consequences. They don't have the pressure of the shame. You know, it has a different kind of context. And so I don't know. I guess when I'm looking at the way that people are responding to the secrets coming to light, says a lot about the options they feel they have on the other side of them, right? Because Regina does have this option to go out the door and rebuild where the others are doomed. They're doomed now. The secrets are out the bag, but there's no hope for a brighter future in this dialogue. Not inside the gloomy house. There's none.
Inside the gloomy house. We're listening to the latest installment of our World of the Play series, where we talk about the latest productions at Everyman Theater. And today we're talking about Ibsen's play, Ghosts. Our guests are Dr. Jean Fernandez, Associate Professor of English at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, Donald Hicken, who directs Ghosts and is the director of the theater program at the Baltimore School for the Arts, and Samara Stone, a licensed certified social worker. Now we have to take a very brief break, but don't go away. And on our way to break, we're hearing Midnight Special by Harry Belafonte. On this day in 1961, Bob Dylan was paid $50 to play harmonica on this track. It was his first studio recording.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them blue for me and you, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and you're listening to your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And that's A Wonderful World, Cabaret by Louis Armstrong. On this day in 1968, he hit number one in the United Kingdom with this track. And at 69 years old, he was the oldest musician to ever score number one in a song in Britain. This hour, we're listening to the latest installment of our World in the Play series, where we look at the latest production at Everyman Theater and wrestle with some of the deep issues found within those plays. The production we discussed this time was Ghosts by Henrik Ibsen, which deals with women's power during the Victorian era, secrets families kept, and the ways in which our puritanical societies make us keep secrets about the most important things that deeply affect our lives and hurt us. Our guests were Dr. Jean Fernandez, Associate Professor of English at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, Donald Hicken, who directed the play Ghosts and is a theater director at the Baltimore School for the Arts, and Samara Stone, who is a clinical, licensed, certified social worker.
Another piece that comes out of this for me when it comes to secrets that comes is emblematic in this play is the role of women. That many times in cultures and in families, it's the women who are the keepers of the secrets for the family to protect. And Ibsen, I can bring this up because he was, again, an early woman's advocate before most men were in this world of ancient misogyny we all live in. I think that's a piece of it, is the role of women in all of this, in our world of secrets.
I'm fascinated by this notion that you were talking about, the sort of Victorian mindset for the women, that their role really was as kind of preservationists. Yeah, I mean, they were charged with keeping it all together no matter what. Even though on one level they seemed to be just powerless, they actually had a very significant role, yeah, in preserving the structure. or the infrastructure.
Yes, they did have a significant role, undoubtedly, but so much of that was perhaps coercive. It was coercive culturally and socially. And part of this paradox was that women were also supposed to be pure. They were part of their, you know, part of their power was something that came out of their, you know, morally superior status in relation to men. And certainly when you had the Contagious Diseases Act of 1864 passed in Victorian England, which allowed any woman in a garrison town to be strip-searched and subjected to a medical examination on suspicion of being a prostitute, it became an instrument by which women could be harassed. But feminists had a really hard time fighting this legislation because women were not supposed to know anything pertaining to something as, you know, depraved as sexually transmitted diseases. So they were unable to actually give voice to their protest. And what they did was they collected these tens of thousands of signatures and laid the petition out on the floor of the House of Commons. That was the silence that women were compelled to maintain. If you were a lady, you didn't speak of these things. So at what point were you a powerful custodian of a family's name and reputation? And at what point were you a prisoner, in many ways, as Mrs. Alving was, sent back into her home in order to maintain, you know, the reputation of the family and to do her duty? That word that keeps...
coming up.
Repeating, yeah, like a hammer blow right through the dialogue. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And well, that was also a period when, speaking about women, that it was a period when prostitution exploded,
yes,
in the world, and especially in the Western world. It became the people being thrown out of work, people being more women than men in society, women having a subservient position. It threw a lot of women in that period into prostitution. In some ways, you see her walking out when she finds out what her secret is. She says, maybe that's where I'm going, right?
And ironically, what her not biological father, yes, but presumed father had, yes, been really propositioning her, yes, with in the early scene of the play. I mean, right, his thing, yeah, was... Yeah. He was making a very tangible offer to her about what kind of profit they could gain. Why don't you partner with me? And so, yeah, it is interesting that it went back to that default option yet again.
Now, I was thinking about it. I'm going to come to the audience in just a minute. Audience, just in a minute, to see your thoughts. I really want to just let me know you want to have a question or idea. We want to get you in this. I was thinking, I'm coming back to secrets again, because I'm obsessed with this ever since I think about this discussion in the play. Because secrets are revealed in families, individually, but they're also revealed in society. In some ways, Ibsen talks a lot about, I mean, his plays are about society, about, yeah, about revealing these secrets. And you know, now we, but, and in some ways, the social psychologists of society, in some ways, are historians who unveil pieces of history that define who we are today, unveil our secrets, whether the secrets of the historicity of racism in society and the new things that come out from the 19th century and the 20th century, or when you see somebody who reveals what really happened in a certain war and that we all kind of look at as a noble experience, but then all the other pieces become revealed and those secrets come out, right? So society has to wrestle with secrets in a larger sense as well. And that becomes... those secrets are very... You know, everything around us is enveloped in a secret.
Yeah. I really think we're all looking for this hero's story, right? We're wanting this ideal that is very different than the reality of human experience sometimes. And so what becomes the secret is what then really displays the human experience. We don't want that. We want the hero's journey. And so I think that when I listen to what you were talking about in wartime, I really think that we want to hear about the valiant courage. We don't want to hear about the struggle in the trench. We want to hear about this thing that inspires us to be larger than life on some level. And so I think when we are able to move those stories out of the way and relate to one another as human beings, I mean, that's when you get a more authentic picture
what this is about.
Because people get very angry when secrets are revealed.
Yes.
Culturally, right?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
People, you know, things I've covered over the years, like the volatility of the Israeli-Palestinian situation. People write, Israeli historians write these new histories about what happened in 1948. Reveal it, and then everybody has to wrestle with that, and people get very angry because you have to wrestle with that. We have to wrestle Johns Hopkins now has to wrestle with their secret because of the STDs and sexually transmitted diseases given to Guatemalans in this experiment. So now people are angry about, you know, this erupts in this anger because things get revealed, they're volcanic. And in this play, also personally, those secrets are volcanic, right? They erupt. I don't just mean for the play, but beyond the play, I'm just saying what it represents beyond the play. It's a volcanic experience to hold secrets and let them erupt.
Yes. And it's significant, I think, that the catalyst for that eruption is the artist. It's Oscar, who's coming back from this bohemian world, and who, in fact, informs Manders that, well, you know, these free love societies where people don't live together, you know, with perhaps under perhaps the laws of church or state, are in fact infinitely superior to the so-called respectable home. But it's Oscar who brings, you know, the secret out of the woodwork, actually. It's the artist who actually is able to accomplish this revelation. So it's interesting, I think, too, that without Oscar, possibly you wouldn't have had that revelation in all its totality. And so it takes perhaps a special kind of talent, a special kind of insight, a special kind of personality to bring about this moment of discovery, this moment of revelation to society. And it's interesting, too, because, you know, even today, people in positions of power and eminence have to guard their secrets zealously. And Captain Alving is a man with a position. You know, there's this memorial being raised to him. He's 10 years dead, but there's still this effort to construct an image. And there's this discussion of whether to name the memorial Mr. Alving or give him his title. And the whole thing just falls apart. And we're not so far away from that kind of scenario even today. You know, our leaders in public life subject to the same kind of scrutiny, the same kind of demolishing of an image that happens. And again, I think the artist, he has some role in this whole
process. That's interesting. I think you're absolutely right. And I think, Donald, I think, let me talk about this both as artist and therapist for a moment. First, the artist. I mean, the artist does do that. I mean, the artist brings out and explodes things for people to have to wrestle with that they don't want to have to take up. They want to keep those secrets buried.
Well, you know, I love the quote from Peter Brook. He said, "The actor chooses to reveal what most of us would prefer to keep hidden." And that is his gift to the audience. And I think that artists do that. You know, they go to those places that the rest of us avoid for the sake of convenience or reputation or whatever, a career. But the artist is always prying those things open, always investigating. And I think your observation about Oswald is wonderful because he really does come back with that sensibility, you know, and that's the lens through which he sees the world. He's not seeing the world in terms of prescribed convention. He's seeing the world through his own viscera. And I think that's what makes artistry so important because, you know, as Shakespeare said, we hold the mirror up, don't we? You know, we say, okay, take a look at yourselves and see what you see.
And the therapist does that.
Yes, right? Absolutely. I think, you know, the role of the therapist is changing more and more today because there was a time when participating in any kind of therapeutic exchange just had such stigma attached to it. But today, people really kind of see their emotional well-being as a part of the human exchange. Like, I am a better human being. I'm a better mother. I'm a better wife when I've dealt with my own intrapsychic struggle and worked through this to some degree. I think what you said about the outing of secrets is very interesting when I think about the lens of technology today, because today we have a world where social media makes the most shameful of things on parade for all to see. Sometimes, whether it's cases where, like the young man who was outed for his homosexual behavior on the college campus, he did not want that to be outed. It aired in social media. Or sometimes even with a younger generation that intentionally shares what we would think of as being a secret for likes. Like, they'll just display these behaviors for likes. I think the gauge of what's secret and shameful is shifting yet again, as it always does, as we continue to progress towards a more authentic human experience.
I think maybe that's one of the things that why I like this play so much and what it does for us in thinking about where we are today is because he was one of those people, Ibsen was one of those people, who used art to explode the secrets and make us look at what was going on in the world around us, especially, again, around the role of women and what women had to offer, which was not supposed to be seen. So I think that, you know, and I think that, folks out here, anybody want to have a thought, please?
So I think this has really been very interesting from the artist to the therapist to the English historian going back to the Victorian time. And we can take this juxtaposition from what happened back in the Victorian, where everything almost was a secret, particularly as you were elevated in society. And today, very few secrets. I mean, everything, as you pointed out, the therapist, the things are exploded. Social media, we find things instantly. So what do we take away from all this? Is it that we're somewhat voyeuristic and we want to know about these secrets, but not our own, but everybody else's?
I think that's exactly it. We absolutely want to hear the secrets over there. But I think sometimes not even really seeing the real impact of our secrecy. I think on some level, if you're just living your life and having your own experience, until someone else kind of judges your behavior, you don't even see the totality of what you're holding secret. So I think the viewpoint of the other always kind of defines just how much of a secret something should be.
Mm-hmm. It's also
also
about hauntedness, though. You know, I mean, on the one hand, we may think of secrets in terms of the audience, the gaze of the audience, the public gaze, which can be voyeuristic. But the whole notion of hauntedness, which this play suggests, it's so much harder to be rid of that. You know, how do secrets somehow have an afterlife of their own? How are we unable to somehow break free of that kind of, hauntedness that simply won't let us get away? And that's the predicament that Mrs. Alving faces. That's the predicament Oscar faces. It seems to be almost, you know, a kind of fate that they have to somehow endure.
It's true. Ibsen had a firmly held belief that fate plays a role in how secrets come back. You know, and there's been a lot of discussion about what the word ghosts really meant. You know, he wrote the play in Danish, and you know, a lot of people say, well, it's, you know, it's skeletons in the closet would be the most accurate English term for it. But it's a little bit more than that. It has to do with his haunting, that there are these, you know, he firmly believed that you cannot escape these things, that the mistakes that you make, the things that you keep secret, are going to come back and get you in the end.
Mm-hmm. They do, Samara. Yeah.
I'm just so struck by the power of our own inner dialogue, that haunting really is the self-shaming and the self-judgment that we're having about whatever choices we've made. And doesn't that kind of frame the power of the secret? You know, if we feel like what we've done is inappropriate, right, and that and we're being haunted by these choices ourselves, well, we fight with greater fervor to hold those things even more secret, right? I mean, it just, I really think about, I wonder, this, we don't get to see Captain himself and what his thoughts were about his own behavior, but whether he felt the need to kind of be so guarded in some of the choices that he'd made. I'd just be curious.
Mm-hmm. Who's you? Right here.
Well, again, I was taken by Ibsen's pioneering spirit about the role of women and their lack of freedom. And something, Dr. Frenin, as you said, I kind of disagree with, but I can see your point, that Mrs. Alving, she prostituted herself by marrying money. What choice did she have? What choice did women have in that era? And that Ibsen was willing to put the finger on it. And that Carpenter, in one of his lines, basically said, what choice did she have? Here it took 10 more years after his death for her to start letting go of the secret. She knew that the servant was the child of her husband in his womanizing ways. I didn't see the compassion on that level, that she was forgiving her husband for his indiscretions. But regardless, I just think Ibsen touched on things now 150 years later that are as deep and as broad about women's choice to be able to say, I'm going to go out and economically take care of myself. Back then, she had no options. Today, she may have, but it's a real difficult set of choices. And I'm not trying to be feminist about it as much as I am in the artist's sense. It's not a secret as much anymore. Women do have choices, but it's still a hard choice to make it on your own at a young age. A 19, 20-year-old, and I have granddaughters that age, and I'm watching them. They don't have a better sense of how it's real clear what I'm going to do. Versus 150 years ago, it was clear you couldn't do much if you didn't do it through a man.
Jean, you were called out first, Amelia, to go first when we were on the ballot.
Oh, yes. I think she poses that question herself, you know, to Manders. When Manders talks about, when the discussion comes up about how Engstrom was paid off to marry the maid in trouble, 12,000 kroner, which of course Engstrom has conveniently forgotten. Then she goes on to, you know, to pose this bold question. Well, what's the difference between that and my choosing to marry Mr. Alving because my sisters convinced me that he was a catch because he had this kind of money, this kind of, you know, fortune at his disposal. So I think she's really raising the question about how it's so convenient to perhaps stigmatize a prostitute. Mm-hmm. So convenient for the respectable woman to despise her fallen sister without recognizing that in many ways they are victims of the same patriarchal system. But in many ways their situations are in no way perhaps significantly different.
Okay.
In a Doll's House, Nora... There's a big part of it is that Nora is holding a secret, and that secret is that the way she saved her husband's life, her husband doesn't think that it was her particularly who did it, but in the end, her secret is exposed, and the husband, she believes that this glorious thing will happen, that he will take the blame, and basically his initial response is very negative towards the secret. How do you think the secret in a Doll's House relates to the secrets in Ghosts?
That's a normal question, I think.
You think?
Yeah.
Oh, good.
Let's start first.
Well, you know, it goes back to what I said before about, you know, Ibsen believing that it's these erosive conventions that people obey and the roles they have to play, they feel they have to play. That are dehumanizing, ultimately. I mean, I think that Nora's decision to leave is not a corrupt one. You know, she's trying to obey the promptings that come from her true self, and that's a pretty revolutionary idea. You know, at the time when that play was written, And I think what Ibsen's calling to question is how, you know, how important is it for us to obey these conventions and play the game, you know? And so I don't think of it so much as, I mean, I know that the secrets are the corrosive element, but I think that what he's trying to get people to understand is that they've got to live, they've got to know themselves, and they've got to live in a mindful way and in a creative way, not just to adopt the conventions. So I think that's really what motivates Nora, and I think it's what actually fascinated Ibsen about taking Nora to the next step, you know, which I think is Mrs. Alving. Am I answering your... Okay.
I also think, you know, Nora is a young woman, and so she has options in some way that are available to a young woman. She's able to leave and perhaps assert herself. Ghosts is about middle age. This is a middle-aged woman. This is a tragedy of middle age. It's much harder to leave. It's much harder to free yourself of a past. Mrs. Alving is burdened by a past. Nora is burdened really by her present circumstances, but Mrs. Alving is haunted. And that's so much harder. How do you run away from your past? How do you run away from the ghosts that haunt you? She's a middle-aged woman, so though she's tried leaving, she's tried to do what Nora did, but she was sent back, and by the end of the play, she can't leave. Yeah. And so she's trapped. And that's a condition of regret that comes, I think, at a much later stage in life. You deal with secrets differently at different phases in your life.
But there is a connection too, I think, in that you know, Nora leaves her children.
Oh yeah.
And I think you know, one of the things that haunted Ibsen was his relationship with his son, and I think that he tried to kind of address that on some levels in this, as you say, this tragedy of middle age. But here she is faced with having to euthanize her only child. And so I think there is a connection there in terms of the stakes.
Oh, yes.
You know, when we talk about the work, you know, and you look at the way Deborah wrestles with that on stage, you know, the stakes can't be any higher.
And Samara, I think if you look at this in today's world, I mean... We're not in the Victorian era, but if you hold things close and you're in the middle age and later in life, it's much more difficult to let those things go.
What you said about us managing the energy of regret differently at different developmental stages is so absolutely true. I mean, because when we're young, you might feel the regret, right? But you still have this sense that I can turn this thing around. I can do something different with the rest of my life. But you're right. She's at this place where now she's having to make the uncomfortable choice to manage the choices that she's made and do it in the most benevolent of ways with her son, because euthanizing him really would give him some sense of mercy and freedom from the pain of what he was dealing with. And so, I mean... What an awful choice to have to say, I may have some regret on the choices I've made, but here I'm having to yet create another layer of regret, but one that at least frees me from the choices of the past, right?
So your comment about the 21st century and the all the sharing, but in fact, if we go back several hundred years to small villages or small tribal units, in fact, everything was out there because there were no secrets.
Exactly.
So this is a kind of a cycle, if you will.
Yeah, I love that. It's absolutely true. And I think that, again, the more authentically we can fully accept the human experience, that's the challenge of society. Are we okay just being the human beings that we are? And if we are, and everything is open under the sun, and there is no sense of shame with your natural human experience, well, then that's beautiful. So you're right. It's kind of this kind of cycle of coming back around to really accepting what is the natural human experience.
Well, I want to thank everybody for coming out for this conversation, The Cost of Keeping a Secret, here at Everyman Theater. And I want to thank Donald Hicken and Dr. Gene Fernandez and Samara Stone for joining us here for this conversation, all of you participating. And thank you all so much. Have a good rest of the day. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer is Andre Melton. On our way out of here, we're hearing Cherry Pink and Apple Blossoms White by Perez Prado, which hit number one on this day in 1955. To hear this show again, podcast past shows, and find out information about our guests and the work they do, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And you can also listen to and download our podcast on iTunes. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.